Antiquities, Book 16. Contents: How Alexander and Aristobulus returned from Rome to their father. How Salome and Pheroras, the king's brother and sister, made use of slanders against them. How Herod, having given wives to Alexander and his circle, sailed to Agrippa at Mytilene, and from there persuaded him to come to Judea. Agrippa's departure for Ionia, and how Herod sailed a second time to meet Agrippa at the Bosporus. The appeal of the Jews of Ionia to Agrippa, in Herod's presence, concerning their complaints against the Greeks. How Agrippa confirmed their laws for them, and Herod returned to Judea. How Herod addressed the people of Jerusalem and remitted a quarter of the past year's taxes for them. How discord arose in Herod's household, since he favored Antipater, his eldest son, while those around Alexander bore the insult badly. How, while Antipater was staying in Rome, Herod brought Alexander and his circle before Caesar and accused them. Alexander's defense before Caesar and his reconciliation with his father. How Herod held games every 5 years in honor of the founding of Caesarea. The embassy of the Jews from Cyrene and Asia to Caesar concerning the wrongs they charged against the Greeks. Copies of the letters that Caesar and Agrippa wrote on their behalf to the cities. How Herod, being short of funds, went down into David's tomb, and after being terrified by an apparition, set up a monument at the tomb. How Archelaus, king of Cappadocia, reconciled Alexander with his father, though Herod had earlier had him bound, and how Archelaus went up to Cappadocia and Herod to Rome. The revolt of those living in Trachonitis, and the reconquest of the region by his generals. How Herod demanded the surrender of the rebels who had fled into Arabia, and, failing to obtain them, marched against them with Saturninus's permission. How Silius the Arab accused Herod before Caesar over his incursion, and how, through Nicolaus, he was cleared of the charges when Caesar had been angry. The slanders of Eurycles against Herod's sons, and how their father had them imprisoned and wrote to Caesar about them. How, when Caesar granted him authority at Berytus before the council, he accused his sons, and how, once put to death, they were buried at Alexandrian. This book covers a period of 12 years. In administering affairs generally, the king was eager to check the various wrongs being committed in the city and the countryside, and so he laid down a law unlike any earlier one, one which he himself enforced. Burglars were to be sold out of the kingdom. This was harsh, not merely as a punishment for the offenders, but it also amounted to an overturning of ancestral custom. For to be enslaved to foreigners who did not share the same way of life, and to be compelled to do whatever they ordered, was, for our people, a sin against religion, not simply a punishment for the one caught, such a penalty having been guarded against in the earlier law. The laws instead required the thief to pay back fourfold, and if he had nothing, to be sold indeed, but not to foreigners, nor into permanent slavery. He had to be released after 6 years. But fixed as it now was, the punishment seemed harsh and lawless, a mark of arrogance, since Herod had set the penalty not as a king, but as a tyrant, with contempt for the common interests of his subjects. These acts, being of a piece with the rest of his character, formed part of the slanders and the ill will felt toward him. At this time, he also made a voyage to Italy, setting out to meet Caesar and to see his sons, who were living in Rome. Caesar received him warmly in every way, and since the boys had now completed their studies, handed them over for him to take home. When they arrived from Italy, the crowds were eager to see the young men, who had become conspicuous to everyone, both adorned by the greatness of the fortune surrounding them and not falling short of royal dignity in their bearing. They at once became objects of envy to Salome, the king's sister, and to those who had prevailed against Mariam through slander. For these people supposed that once the young men came to power, they would pay the penalty for the wrongs done to their mother. So they carried this same fear over into slander against the brothers, spreading the story that the young men took no pleasure in being with their father because of their mother's death, to the point that it did not even seem right to them to come into the presence of the murderer of the woman who bore them. By shifting in this way from truth to a plausible pretext for their charge, they were able to do harm and strip away the goodwill Herod felt toward his sons, for they did not say these things to him directly, but scattered such talk among the rest of the populace. Once this was carried back to Herod, a hatred was quietly built up that not even nature itself would overcome as time passed. At that time, however, the king, though given over more than ever to every kind of suspicion and slander, still, out of a father's natural affection, granted the young men what honor was due and joined them in marriage, now that they were of age. To Aristobulus he gave Berenice, the daughter of Salome, and to Alexander, Glaphyra, the daughter of Archelaus, king of Cappadocia. Having settled these matters, when he learned that Marcus Agrippa had sailed back from Italy to Asia, Herod hurried to him and pressed him to come into his own kingdom and receive what was owed him from a man who was both a stranger and a friend. Agrippa yielded to his earnest insistence and came to Judea, and Herod left nothing undone to please him. He welcomed him in the newly founded cities, and besides showing him the buildings, he provided him and his friends with every enjoyment of a lavish way of life, both at Sebaste and at Caesarea by the harbor he had built, and in the fortresses he had constructed at great expense, Alexandrian, Herodian, and Hyrcania. He also brought him to the city of Jerusalem, where the whole population came out to meet him in festive dress and welcomed the man with acclamations. Agrippa offered a hecatomb to God and feasted the people on a scale matching the grandest occasions. He himself, though he would gladly have stayed even more days for his own pleasure, was pressed for time, for with winter coming on, he did not think it safe to make the return voyage to Ionia, which he was obliged to do. So Agrippa sailed away, after Herod had honored both him and the most distinguished of his companions with many gifts. The king spent the winter at home, and in spring hurried to meet Agrippa again, knowing that he was leading the way for a campaign to the Bosporus. Sailing by way of Rhodes and Kos, he put in there, expecting to catch up with Agrippa near Lesbos, but there a north wind caught him and kept the ships from putting out. He stayed on several days at Chios, welcoming many who came to him and helping them with royal gifts. And seeing that the city's colonnade had fallen down one that had been demolished in the Mithridatic War, and, unlike other structures, could not easily be restored because of its size and beauty, he gave money enough not merely to cover, but to exceed what was needed to complete the work, instructing the people not to let it lie neglected, but to raise it quickly and restore to the city its own ornament. Once the wind had died down, he sailed on to Mytilene, and from there was carried to Byzantium. And hearing that Agrippa had already sailed past the Cyanean rocks, he pressed on as fast as he could. Catching up with him near Sinope in Pontus, he came into view unexpectedly, sailing up with his ships, and his arrival was warmly welcomed, with many expressions of affection, since Agrippa now felt he had received the surest proof of Herod's goodwill toward him. That the king had made so long a voyage and had not failed him in his need, valuing it above even leaving behind the government and administration of his own affairs. In short, throughout the campaign Herod was everything to him, a partner in matters of business, an advisor in particular affairs, a pleasant companion even in times of relaxation, and the only one who shared with him both burdensome things, out of good will, and pleasant things, out of the honor due him. When they had finished the business in Pontus for which Agrippa had been sent, they decided not to make the return journey by sea, but instead crossed through Paphlagonia and Cappadocia, and from there traveled through Greater Phrygia to Ephesus, then sailed again from Ephesus to Samos. Many benefits were conferred by the king in each city according to the needs of those who approached him. For he himself did not hold back whatever could be provided through money, meeting the expenses from his own funds, and in matters that some sought from Agrippa, he acted as intermediary, arranging that none of the petitioners went away disappointed. Since Agrippa too was generous and large-minded in granting whatever was asked of him without burdening anyone else, the king's influence did the most to spur him toward acts of kindness, for Agrippa was never slow to act. He reconciled Agrippa with the people of Ilium, settled for the Chians their debts to Caesar's agents and freed them from the taxes, and for the others he intervened as each case required. While they were then in Ionia, a great number of Jews living in the cities came forward, seizing the opportunity and speaking freely, and told of the wrongs done to them. That they were not permitted to follow their own laws, and were forced to appear in court, harassed by local magistrates on holy days, and were being deprived of the funds dedicated for Jerusalem, being compelled to take part in military service and public duties, and to spend on these the sacred money from all of which they had always been exempt, since the Romans had allowed them to live by their own laws. As they cried out in this way, the king arranged for Agrippa to hear their case argued, and assigned Nicolaus, one of his friends, to speak the just case on their behalf. Agrippa then made the leading Romans and the kings and princes present with him into a council, and Nicolaus stood up and spoke on behalf of the Jews as follows. Great Agrippa, everyone who has suffered wrong must of necessity take refuge with those who have the power to remove such wrongs, but those who come to you now do so with confidence besides. For having received from you before the very things they had often prayed for, they now ask only that the favors granted through you not be taken away by the very men who gave them, especially since they received these favors from those who alone had the power to grant them, and are being deprived of them by no one of higher standing, but by men whom they know to be subjects on an equal footing with themselves, just as you are. Whether great things were granted to them or small, it is a credit to those who received them that they proved themselves worthy of so much, but it is shameful for those who gave the favors not to make good on them as well. Those, however, who stand in their way and harass the Jews clearly wrong both parties. The recipients, if they do not consider them worthy men to whom the rulers themselves bore witness by granting such things. And the givers, if they think it right that their own favors should prove unreliable. If one were to ask these people which of two things they would rather be deprived of their life, or their ancestral customs, the processions, the sacrifices, the festivals they hold in honor of the gods they recognize, I know well that they would choose to suffer anything rather than abolish any part of their ancestral ways. For it is on this very account that most men choose war, guarding against transgressing them, and we measure the prosperity that the whole human race now enjoys through you by this, that it is possible for each people, in its own land, to honor its own ways, and so to grow and to live. This then they would not choose to suffer themselves, and yet they force it upon others, as if they were not committing an equal impiety, whether they neglect the pious duties owed to their own gods, or unlawfully destroy the customs proper to others. Let us examine this further point. Is there any people, or city, or common nation of men, for whom the protection of your rule and the power of Rome has not been the greatest of blessings? Would anyone wish the favors that come from it to be void? No one, not even a madman, for there is no one who does not share in them, both privately and in common. Indeed, those who take away certain things that you have granted leave nothing secure, even for those very things which they hold on your account. Yet it is not even possible to measure the benefits these people owe you. For if they were to reckon up both their kingdom of old and their present government, with all the many things that have contributed to their prosperity, it is enough, above all, that they no longer appear as slaves, but as free men. As for what belongs to us, even when we conduct our own affairs splendidly, it gives no cause for envy. For it is through you that we prosper along with everyone else, and we have asked to share in only this one thing, to preserve our ancestral piety without hindrance, which, considered in itself, would seem to be a matter of no envy, and one that lies with those who permit it to grant. For the divine, if it delights in being honored, delights also in those who allow it to be honored. Nothing in our customs is inhuman. All of them are pious and consecrated by the justice we habitually observe. Nor do we conceal the precepts we follow in life as reminders of piety and of proper human conduct. We set aside the seventh day of the week for the study of our customs and law, considering the practice of these, like anything else, a discipline through which we will avoid wrongdoing. These customs are good, if one examines them on their own merits, and they are ancient for us, even if some do not think so, so that the honor owed to their antiquity is hard to instill in those who have not received and preserved them faithfully. Of these things they now strip us through harassment, destroying, under false pretenses, the funds we contribute to God, and openly committing sacrilege, imposing taxes and dragging us before courts and to other business even on our festivals, not out of any need arising from actual dealings, but out of spite for the religion they know we hold, bearing toward us a hatred that is neither just nor within their own right to indulge. For your rule, having become one over all peoples, renders goodwill effective and ill will ineffective for those who choose the latter instead of the former. This, then, is what we ask, great Agrippa, that we not suffer harm, nor be harassed, nor be prevented from following our own customs, nor be deprived of our possessions, nor be forced by these men into what we do not force upon them ourselves. For these things are not only just, but were granted by you yourselves before. We could read out many decrees of the Senate, and the bronze tablets set up on the Capitol concerning these matters, decrees plainly granted only after testing our loyalty to you, and binding even had you bestowed on us nothing else at all. For to put it simply, you have preserved for all mankind, not for us alone, what already existed, and by adding more than anyone hoped for you do good through your rule. Anyone who tried to catalog the good fortune each people enjoys through you would make the account endless. But to show that we ourselves justly deserve all of this, it is enough, passing over what has already been said, to point to the man who now rules us and sits here beside you. What goodwill toward your house has he ever left undone? What loyalty has he ever fallen short of? What honor has he failed to conceive? What need of yours has he not put first? Why then should our gratitude not be counted among the many benefits you have received? It would perhaps also be good not to leave unmentioned the valor of his father Antipater, who came to Caesar's aid with 2,000 infantry when Caesar had invaded Egypt and proved second to none, either in the land battles or when ships were needed. What need is there to say how great a weight they threw onto the scale at that critical moment, and how many gifts, and of what kind, each of them individually received from Caesar for it? Enough to recall the letters Caesar then wrote to the Senate, and how Antipater publicly received honors and citizenship. These proofs will suffice to show that we possess these favors deservedly, and to ask that you confirm them, you, from whom, even had they not been granted before, one could hope for them, given the king's disposition toward you and yours toward him. We are told by the Jews there that you entered the country graciously, that you offered God whole burnt sacrifices, honoring him with complete vows, that you feasted the people, and that you accepted the gifts of hospitality they offered. All this, for a nation and a city, must be reckoned tokens of welcome and pledges of friendship toward a man in charge of so many affairs. A friendship you showed the Jewish nation, procured for it by Herod's own hospitality. In reminding you of these things, and of the king himself who is present and sits here beside you, we ask nothing extravagant, only that you not stand by and let others take away what you yourselves have granted. When Nicolaus had finished speaking in this way, the Greeks offered no rebuttal at all. They were not arguing a case as though in a court, but simply pressing by force to keep on doing as they pleased. They had no defense to offer for what they were doing, only the excuse that, since they inhabited the country, the Jews were now wronging them in everything. The Jews, for their part, showed themselves to be natives of the land, doing no harm even as they honored their own customs while living there. Agrippa, seeing that the Greeks were resorting to force, replied as follows. Because of Herod's goodwill and friendship toward him, he was ready to grant the Jews absolutely anything. But what they were asking for also seemed just in its own right. So that even if they had asked for still more, he would not have hesitated to grant whatever did not burden Roman rule. But since what they had already been granted must not be nullified, he confirmed that they should continue, unmolested, in their own customs. With these words, he dissolved the assembly. Herod, standing by, embraced him and acknowledged his gratitude for his disposition toward him. Agrippa, showing the same warmth in return, embraced him just as fully, clasping and kissing him. Then he withdrew for the time. The king decided to sail home from Samos, and having taken leave of Agrippa, he put out to sea, landing at Caesarea not many days later, having found favorable winds. From there he went up to Jerusalem and gathered the whole people in assembly. A great crowd had come in also from the countryside. Coming forward, he gave an account of his entire journey abroad, and told them how, because of him, the Jews throughout Asia would from now on live unmolested. And, exulting over his good fortune generally, and over how he had administered the kingdom, claiming that he had left out nothing that served their interests, he remitted to them a quarter of the previous year's taxes. The people, won over both by his words and by his generosity, went away with the greatest joy, calling down many blessings on the king. Meanwhile, the strife within the household kept advancing and taking a harsher turn. Salome had, as it were by inheritance, taken over the hatred against the young men, and everything that had won her success against their mother was now turning into recklessness and boldness, so that she would leave none of Mariam's children alive who might avenge, through her death, the woman put to death because of her. The young men, for their part, harbored some boldness and ill will toward their father as well, both from remembering how their mother had suffered undeservedly, and from their own desire to rule. So once again, the same evil as before repeated itself. Abuse from the young men against Salome and Pharaoh's, and malicious scheming from these two against the youths, with calculated plotting behind it. The hatred on both sides was equal, but the manner of hating was not the same. The young men were quick to abuse and reproach openly, thinking in their inexperience that giving free rein to anger was noble. The others did not act the same way, but employed their slanders in a calculating and malicious fashion, constantly egging the youths on, and then counting their boldness as proof that they would turn to violence against their father. For their refusal to feel shame at their mother's alleged offenses, and their conviction that she had not suffered justly, was, they claimed, uncontrollable in one who thought he knew the guilty party and would take revenge even with his own hand. In the end, the whole city was filled with talk of this kind, and, as in a contest, the young men's inexperience won sympathy, but Salome's careful diligence prevailed. She drew the material for proving her charges true from the young men's own conduct. For being so aggrieved at their mother's death, and since Salome kept speaking ill of both her and them, they were determined to show, as was true, that their mother's ruin was pitiable, and that they themselves were pitiable, forced as they were to live with her murderers and to share meals with them. These things went further still, since the strife had free rein during the king's absence abroad. When Herod returned and addressed the people, as we have already related, reports at once reached him from Pharaoh's and Salome that he was in great danger from the young men, who were openly threatening that they would not rest until they had avenged their mother's murder. They added further that the young men were pinning their hopes on Archelaus, king of Cappadocia, expecting through him to gain access to Caesar and to bring accusations against their father. On hearing this, Herod was troubled at once, and all the more shaken because others too were reporting the same thing. He was thrown back into his misfortune, reckoning first that he had gotten no good from either his dearest ones or the wife he had loved, on account of the turmoil that kept arising in his household, and taking what had now befallen him to be even heavier and greater than those earlier troubles, he was thrown into confusion of soul. For in truth, divine fortune kept adding to him, beyond all hope, the greatest external successes, while at home the greatest and most unexpected misfortunes kept befalling him, each running to a degree no one would have imagined, so that it made a genuine contest which was the greater excess. Whether it would be worth exchanging so much external good fortune for his domestic troubles, or escaping so great a weight of misfortune among his own, by never having possessed the admired splendor of his kingdom at all. Troubled and disposed in this way, in order to bring down the young men, Herod brought forward another son of his, born to him while he was still a private citizen, and made a show of honoring him. His name was Antipater, not yet, as he later did, wholly won over by him and referring everything to him, but thinking rather to strip Mariam's sons of their arrogance, managing the move chiefly as a lesson to them. For their self-will, he reasoned, would not persist in them if they were persuaded that succession to the kingdom was not owed to them alone as a matter of necessity. He therefore brought in Antipater as a kind of reserve, thinking he was planning wisely, and that once the young men had been checked, he would be free, in due time, to make the better choice. But it did not turn out as he had intended. It seemed to his sons that he had treated them with no small degree of spite, and Antipater, being clever by nature, once he had laid claim to a freedom of speech he had never before had reason to hope for, adopted a single strategy of harm. Since his brothers would not yield the first place, he clung close to his father, already estranged by the slanders, and easy to manage toward whatever he was bent on, so that things constantly grew far worse for those under accusation. The reports did not come from him alone. He was careful not to seem to be the source of such disclosures himself, but he made use of accomplices who were beyond suspicion and who would be believed to be acting out of goodwill toward the king. And by now, a good number of people had begun currying favor with him for what they hoped to gain from it, winning Herod over by seeming to speak out of loyal concern. As these many faces worked together faithfully in concert, still more material kept coming from the young men themselves. Often there were tears provoked by the insults done to them, invocations of their mother, and they made a habit of openly charging their father before their friends with injustice. All of which Antipater's circle, watching for their moment, maliciously seized on and reported back to Herod in exaggerated form, producing no small degree of strife within the household. The king, distressed by the slanders and wanting to humble Mariam's sons, kept giving Antipater ever greater marks of honor. And in the end, completely won over, he brought in Antipater's mother as well. And, writing repeatedly to Caesar on his behalf, commended him all the more earnestly in private. Then, when Agrippa was going up to Rome after his 10-year administration of the provinces of Asia, Herod sailed from Judea to meet him, and brought only Antipater with him, handing him over to be taken up to Rome laden with many gifts, to become a friend to Caesar, so that everything already seemed to rest on him, and the young men appeared to have been pushed aside entirely from any share in power. As for honor and appearing to hold first place, things went well for Antipater during his time abroad. Since Herod had written letters to all his friends, he was a marked man in Rome. But he was troubled at not being present and not having ready opportunity to keep slandering his brothers, and he feared all the more a change of heart in his father, in case he should on his own decide to think more kindly of Mariam's sons. Turning this over in his mind, he did not abandon his course, but even from a distance, whenever he hoped to distress his father and provoke him against his brothers, he wrote constantly, ostensibly out of great concern for him, but in truth trading on the hope his natural malice held out, a hope substantial in its own right, until he had brought Herod to such a pitch of anger and ill repute that, already hostile toward the young men, yet hesitant to plunge into so grave an affair. Lest he err either through negligence or through rashness, Herod judged it better to sail to Rome and there accuse his sons before Caesar, rather than allow himself any act so suspect on account of its enormous impiety. So he went up to Rome and pressed on as far as the city of Aquileia to meet Caesar. There, gaining audience and asking leave to speak concerning the great misfortunes he believed had befallen him, he brought his sons forward and accused them of madness and of an actual plot, claiming that, holding him in enmity, they had set every effort on doing away with their own father and seizing the kingdom by the cruelest means. He himself, he said, even in dying, should have the right, not merely of necessity but by judgment, granted him by Caesar, to hand power over to whichever son had remained more loyal to him. But for them, it was not chiefly a matter of the throne. Even were they to be deprived of that too, life itself mattered less to them, if only they could manage to kill their father. So savage and polluted a hatred had eaten into their souls. This misfortune he himself had borne for a long time, and now he was forced to lay it out before Caesar and to defile his ears with such a tale. And yet what harsh thing had they suffered at his hands? On what ground did they complain that he was oppressive? How could it be right and just that he not be master of a rule he himself had won through many labors and dangers, free to hold it and to give it to whoever deserved it? For this too, along with everything else, he had set up as a prize for piety, offered to whichever son should show such devoted care toward the one who would one day become king, since so great a reward was there to gain. That it was not even pious of them to meddle in this matter was perfectly plain. Whoever is forever brooding on the kingdom necessarily reckons in, along with it, the death of the one who begot him, since there is no other way to receive power. As for himself, up to now he had failed his sons in nothing owed to those raised as royalty and as a king's children, not in adornment, not in attendance, not in luxury, but had even provided them the most distinguished marriages, one to his own sister's daughter and Alexander to the daughter of King Archelaus. And the greatest thing of all, even with such grievances against them, he had not used the power he held to deal with them himself, but had brought them before Caesar, the common benefactor of all, and, setting aside every power that either a wronged father or a plotted against king might wield, had presented them for judgment on equal terms. Yet it would be necessary that he not go entirely unavenged, nor live out his life in the greatest fear, nor indeed would it profit them, given what they had contemplated, to go on seeing the sun, should they now escape, having in effect both committed and about to suffer the gravest of human deeds. In this passionate manner Herod laid these charges against his own sons before Caesar. Even while he was still speaking, the young men were already in tears and confusion, and all the more once Herod ended his speech. For while they held in their own conscience the confident knowledge that they stood clear of any such impiety, they knew that a charge brought by a father is hard to answer, hard as indeed it was, and that speaking with the frankness the moment called for would not look becoming, if it meant always and urgently to refute it as a mistake. So they were at a loss for words, and there were tears, and finally a wail more moving than words, since they were afraid that they would seem to be at a loss out of a guilty conscience, yet found no easy defense, hampered as they were by their youth and by the turmoil they had suffered. Caesar, watching them as they stood, did not read their state as the senselessness of a genuinely troubled conscience, but as hesitation born of inexperience and of natural restraint. And those present were moved to pity for them individually, and they stirred their father too, who was seized by real feeling. When they saw a measure of goodwill both in him and in Caesar, and saw that everyone else present was weeping with them or at least sharing their grief, one of the two, Alexander, addressed his father directly and set about dissolving the charges. "Father," he said, "your goodwill toward us is plain even in this very trial. If you had truly intended anything harsh against us, you would not have brought us before the man who saves everyone. Having full authority as king and as father to punish wrongdoers yourself, to bring the matter to Rome and make this man a witness to it was the act of one who meant to save us, not destroy us. No one who intends to kill a man leads him into temples and shrines. Our own case is worse still. We could not bear to go on living if we were believed to have wronged such a father in such a way. And it may be worse to live under suspicion of wrongdoing, though innocent, than to die for wrongs we did not commit. If frank speech can find room for the truth, it will be a blessing both to persuade you and to escape this danger. But if the slander prevails regardless, this sunlight is superfluous to us. Why should we go on looking at it under such suspicion? To say that young men desire kingship is a charge conveniently aimed at the young, and adding the memory of our unhappy mother is enough, on top of her first misfortune, to manufacture our present one. But consider whether these are not common charges, equally available against anyone. Nothing prevents it being said of any reigning king's sons, if they are young and their mother has died, that all of them are suspected of plotting against their father. Yet mere suspicion is not sufficient ground for so grave a charge of impiety. Let someone say whether such a thing has actually been attempted by us, a charge that even things not otherwise believable tend to gain credit from, once acted upon. Can anyone point to the preparation of poison, a conspiracy of age mates, the corruption of household slaves, or letters written against you? And yet each of these things is sometimes fabricated by slander even when it never happened. For a household divided against itself is a hard thing in a kingdom, and the very throne, which you call a prize of piety, often becomes for the most depraved of men an occasion of hope for which they hold back at nothing in their malice. No one then will charge us with any actual wrongdoing, but how could anyone dissolve mere slanders if he refuses to listen? We did speak with some frankness, not against you, for that would have been unjust, but against those who did not keep silent about whatever was said. One of us wept for our mother, not because she is dead, but because even dead she was spoken of badly by men unworthy to do so. Do we desire the throne that we know our father holds? For what purpose, wanting what? If we already have the honors of kings, as indeed we do, why should we chase after empty ambitions? And if we do not, do we not still hope for them? Or did we expect, by murdering you, to gain control of the kingdom, we, for whom, after such a deed, neither land would be passable nor sea navigable? Would the piety and religion of your subjects of this whole nation have tolerated men who killed their father holding power and entering the most holy temple you yourself built? But suppose we had despised everything else. Could anyone, having committed murder, remain unpunished while Caesar lives? You did not beget sons so impious, nor so senseless, perhaps more unfortunate than was good for you, but not that. If you have no charges and find no plots, what is sufficient, in your eyes, to give credence to such monstrous impiety? Our mother is dead. But surely what concerned her was fit only to admonish us, not to provoke us to such a thing. We could say a great deal more in our defense, but there is no arguing a case for things that never happened. And so, with Caesar, master of all, mediating this moment, we propose this agreement. If you receive from the truth itself an assurance free of suspicion regarding your disposition toward us, Father, we will live, though not even so very happily, for a false charge is itself a terrible thing among great evils. But if any dread still remains, you may continue in your own piety, and we will answer for ourselves. Life is not so precious to us that we would wish to keep it at the cost of wronging the one who gave it to us. While Alexander was speaking in this way, Caesar, who had not believed the charge in its full weight even before, was moved still further and kept looking steadily at Herod, seeing that he too was somewhat overcome. And anguish had settled on those present, and the report, spreading through the court, turned opinion against the king. For the sheer implausibility of the slander, together with the pitiable spectacle of young men in the flower of youth and beauty, drew sympathy toward them. And still more so once Alexander had met the charge so skillfully and with such good sense in his speech. Even they no longer wore the same expression, still weeping, still bowed toward the ground in dejection, but a better hope was now showing through. The king, seeing that he was thought to have made a reasonable accusation from what had persuaded him, yet had nothing to prove it, felt the need of some kind of defense himself. Caesar, after pausing a little, said that even if the young men appeared far removed from the charge against them, they had still erred in this very thing, in not presenting themselves to their father in such a way that no talk of this sort could even have arisen concerning them. He urged Herod to cast aside all suspicion and be reconciled with his sons, for it was not right, he said, even to believe such things against his own offspring. A change of heart, he said, could not only heal what had happened but could strengthen their mutual goodwill, since each side, in making amends for the rashness of their suspicion, would resolve to treat the other with still greater regard. With such counsel, he gave the young men a nod. And when they wished to fall at their father's feet in supplication, he took hold of them beforehand and embraced them, weeping, one after the other in turn, so that not one of those present, free man or slave, remained untouched. Then, having given thanks to Caesar, they went off together, and with them Antipater, pretending to rejoice at the reconciliation. In the days that followed, Herod presented Caesar with 300 talents, since he was providing games and distributions for the Roman people. And Caesar, in turn, gave him half the revenue of the copper mines of Cyprus and oversight of the other half, and honored him in other ways as well with gifts of hospitality and lodging, and granted him authority concerning the kingdom to appoint whichever of his sons he chose as successor, or even to divide the honor among them all, as he came to each in turn. When Herod was now ready to act on this at once, Caesar said he would not permit it while he lived. Herod must retain control both of the kingdom and of his sons. On these terms, he set out again for Judea. During his absence, a considerable part of his realm around Trachonitis had revolted, but the generals left in charge subdued them and forced them back into obedience. As Herod sailed with his sons and came to Eleusa in Cilicia, now renamed Sebaste, he met Archelaus, king of Cappadocia, who received him warmly, delighted at the reconciliation of the sons and that Alexander, who had married his daughter, had been cleared of the charge. And they exchanged gifts of the kind fitting for kings. From there, Herod went on to Judea, and coming into the temple, he addressed the people about what had happened during his journey abroad, recounting Caesar's warmth toward him and whatever else, in detail, he judged useful both for himself and for the others to know. Finally, he closed his speech with an admonition concerning his sons, urging both the court and the rest of the people toward harmony, and declaring that his sons would be kings after him, first Antipater, and then Alexander and Aristobulus, the sons of Mariam. For the present, he asked that all look to him alone, and regard him as king and master of everyone, since he was neither hindered by old age, being at the time of life most experienced for rule, nor lacking in the other capacities that make it possible both to hold a kingdom and to govern one's children. and he said that if the officers and the army looked to him alone, their life would be untroubled, and every foundation of happiness would come to them from one another. Having said this, he dismissed the assembly, having spoken to the satisfaction of most, but not of all in the same way. For by then many had already been unsettled by the rivalry and by the hopes he had given his sons, and were reaching after change. About this time, Caesarea Sebeste was completed, the whole structure having reached its finish in the 10th year, though the original schedule had run out, so that it fell in the 28th year of his reign, in the 192nd Olympiad. There were at once, for its dedication, greater festivals and the most lavish preparations, for he had announced a contest in music and athletic games, and had prepared a great number of gladiators and wild beasts and horse races, and the most costly of the entertainments practiced both at Rome and among certain other peoples. He dedicated this contest too to Caesar, having arranged to hold it every 5 years. And Caesar sent him, from his own resources, all the equipment needed for such things, adorning Herod's generosity with his own. Caesar's wife Julia, too, on her own account, sent many of the costliest things from Rome, so that the whole display fell short in nothing, being valued together at 500 talents. When a great crowd had gathered in the city to see the spectacle, along with embassies which the various peoples sent because of the benefits they had received, he received them all with lodging, banquets, and continuous festivities, the celebration offering, in the daytime, the diversions of the spectacles, and at night the merriment and the lavish expense devoted to it, so that his magnanimity became famous. For in everything he undertook, he was eager to surpass the display of whatever had been done before. And it is said that Caesar himself and Agrippa often remarked that the extent of Herod's realm fell short of the greatness of spirit within him, and that he deserved to hold the kingdom of all Syria and Egypt as well. After this festival and these celebrations, he raised another city in the plain called Capharsaba, choosing a well-watered spot and excellent land for planting, with a river flowing around the city itself and a very fine grove, remarkable for the size of its trees, surrounding it. This he named Antipatris, after his father Antipater. He also built, above Jericho, a place named for his mother, one outstanding for its security and most pleasant for lodging, and called it Cypros. For his brother Phasael, out of the affection he had felt for him, he dedicated the finest memorials. He raised a tower in the city itself, no smaller than the one at Pharos, which he called Phasael, serving both as part of the city's defenses and as a memorial to the deceased through its name. He also founded, in his honor, a city of the same name in the plain of Jericho, on the road going north, through which he made the surrounding country, which had been desolate, more productive by the care of its settlers. This too he called Phasaelis. As for his other benefactions, it would be impossible to say how many he bestowed on cities both in Syria and throughout Greece, and wherever else he happened to travel. For he seems to have granted generously many public services, the construction of public works, and money to those in need, for the upkeep of earlier works that had fallen into neglect. But the greatest and most notable of his achievements were these. For the Rhodians, he raised the temple of Pythian Apollo at his own expense and gave them many talents of silver for shipbuilding. For the people of Nicopolis, founded near Actium by Caesar, he helped construct most of their public buildings. For the people of Antioch in Syria, who inhabit the greatest city there, one cut lengthwise by a broad street, he paved the open roadway on either side with colonnades and polished stone, greatly benefiting both its adornment and the convenience of its inhabitants. And the games at Olympia, which had grown far less honorable than their name through lack of funds, he made more valuable, establishing revenues for them and enhancing the festival with sacrifices and other adornment. And because of this generosity, he was inscribed by the Eleans as perpetual president of the games. To most other people, it comes naturally to wonder at the contradiction in his nature. For when we look to the acts of generosity and the benefactions he showed toward all mankind, there is no way one could deny, even among those honored less by him, that his nature was most beneficent. But when one looks instead to the punishments and the wrongs he inflicted on his subjects and on his closest kin, and takes note of the harshness and the implacability of his character, he will be judged to seem savage and a stranger to all moderation. For this reason, some think that a different and conflicting disposition arose in him. I myself, however, do not hold it so, but suppose one and the same cause behind both. Being a lover of honor and powerfully overcome by that passion, he was driven toward magnanimity whenever there was any hope, whether of future remembrance or of present praise. But since he spent beyond his means on this account, he was forced to be harsh toward his subjects, for the vast sums spent on those he lavished them upon made him, out of what he took in return, a source of hardship. And being aware of the wrongs he did his subjects for this reason, and that he was hated for it, he did not think it easy to correct these faults, nor indeed would that have served his revenues, but instead made their very ill will an occasion for further gain, out of a spirit of rivalry. As for those closest to him, if anyone failed in word to show due submissive respect, or seemed to stir against his rule in any way, he could not master himself, and pursued kin and friends alike, punishing them as though they were enemies, out of his wish to be honored by himself alone, treating such faults as an assault on that honor. And my proof of this passion, that it was very great in him, lies also in what happened concerning the honors paid to Caesar and Agrippa and his other friends, for the same regard he showed toward. He asked to be courted by the very people he considered his betters, and thought he was offering them the finest thing he had to give when, by his generosity, he revealed his own desire to receive the same treatment in return. The Jewish nation, however, is by law estranged from all such practices, and has grown accustomed to prize justice over glory. For that reason, nothing pleased Herod less than the fact that it was not possible to flatter the king's love of honor with statues, temples, or similar devices. This, I think, was the cause of Herod's offenses against his own household and counselors, and of his benefactions toward outsiders who had no claim on him. The cities of Asia and of Libya near Cyrene were mistreating the Jews who lived among them. Earlier kings had granted them equality before the law, but now the Greeks were harassing them so badly that they were even seizing sacred funds and doing them harm in particular matters. Suffering these wrongs and finding no end to the Greeks' inhumanity, the Jews sent envoys to Caesar about this as well, and he granted them the same equal taxation, writing to the governors of the provinces. We have appended copies of these letters as evidence of the disposition that our rulers have shown toward us from of old. Caesar Augustus, high priest, holding tribunician power, declares, "Since the Jewish nation has been found grateful toward the Roman people, not only at the present time, but also in the past, and especially in the time of my father, the Emperor Caesar, and their high priest Hyrcanus, it has seemed good to me and to my council, under oath, with the consent of the Roman people, that the Jews should live by their own institutions according to their ancestral law, just as they did under Hyrcanus, high priest of the Most High God. That their temples be inviolable, and that funds be sent up to Jerusalem and handed over to the receivers at Jerusalem, and that they not be required to give sureties on the Sabbath or on the preparation day before it, from the ninth hour onward. If anyone is caught stealing their sacred books or their sacred funds, whether from the synagogue or from the meeting hall, he shall be treated as a temple robber, and his property shall be confiscated to the Roman treasury. As for the decree presented to me by them concerning the piety I show to all people, and concerning Gaius Marcius Censorinus, I order that this edict too be set up in the most conspicuous place assigned to me by the League of Asia at Ancyra. If anyone transgresses any of the above, he shall pay no small penalty. This has been inscribed on a stele in the Temple of Caesar. Caesar to Norbanus Flaccus, greetings. Whatever Jews there are who, by ancient custom, are accustomed to bring sacred funds and send them up, let them do so without hindrance to Jerusalem. So much for Caesar's letter. Agrippa too wrote on behalf of the Jews in the following manner. Agrippa to the magistrates, council, and people of Ephesus, greetings. I wish the Jews in Asia to have the oversight and safeguarding, according to their ancestral custom, of the sacred funds brought to the temple in Jerusalem. As for those who steal sacred writings belonging to the Jews and take refuge in places of asylum, I wish them dragged out and handed over to the Jews, by the same right by which temple robbers are dragged out. I have also written to Silenus the governor, that no one compel a Jew to give sureties on the Sabbath. Marcus Agrippa to the magistrates, council, and people of Cyrene, greetings. The Jews in Cyrene, on whose behalf Augustus has already written to Flavius, the present governor of Libya, and to the other officials of the province, that the sacred funds be sent up to Jerusalem without hindrance, as is their ancestral custom, have now approached me, saying that certain informers are harassing them and preventing them under the pretext of taxes not actually owed. I order that they be restored without being troubled in any way, and that if any of the cities have taken sacred funds from them, those responsible in each case make restitution to the Jews there. Gaius Norbanus Flaccus, proconsul, to the magistrates of Sardis, greetings. Caesar has written to me ordering that the Jews not be hindered from gathering money according to their ancestral custom, and sending it up to Jerusalem, whatever the amount may be. I have therefore written to you, so that you may know that this is what Caesar, and I wish to be done. No less did Julius Antonius, the proconsul, write as follows to the magistrates, council, and people of Ephesus. The Jews living in Asia, when I was administering justice at Ephesus on the Ides of February, showed me that Caesar Augustus and Agrippa had granted them the right to live by their own laws and customs, and to make, without hindrance, the offerings of first fruits which each of them, out of personal devotion and piety toward the divine, brings together with the rest to send up. They asked that I too should confirm my own decision in accordance with the grants made by Augustus and Agrippa. I therefore wish you to know that, in keeping with the wishes of Augustus and Agrippa, I permit them to use and observe their ancestral customs without hindrance. I have set these documents down of necessity, since the records of our affairs are bound to reach the Greeks for the most part, to show them that we have always obtained every honor and have never been hindered by our rulers from following our ancestral customs, but rather have been assisted in matters of worship and in the honors paid to God. I make frequent mention of these things, distinguishing the various peoples and removing the causes of the hatred that has taken root, unreasonably, between us and them on both sides. In matters of custom, no nation always keeps to the same practices, and even from city to city there is often great divergence. But the pursuit of justice, common to all people alike, is most advantageous to Greeks and barbarians alike, and it is to this above all that our laws pay heed, and if we abide by them purely, they render us well-disposed and friendly toward everyone. For this reason, we ought to demand the same of others, and it should not be thought that what differs in practice is therefore alien, but rather that what tends toward moral goodness is what matters, for this is common to all and alone sufficient to preserve human life. I now return to the continuous thread of the history. Herod, spending lavishly both on projects abroad and within his kingdom, had earlier heard that Hyrcanus, the king before him, on opening the tomb of David, had taken from it 3,000 talents of silver, and that far more still remained, enough to supply every expense. He had long had the undertaking in mind, and at that time, opening the tomb by night, he went in, taking care to remain as invisible as possible to the city, and bringing with him only his most trusted friends. He found no hoard of money as Hyrcanus had, but he did find a great quantity of gold ornaments and precious objects, all of which he removed. He was eager, however, to press his search further inward, even to the very chambers where the bodies of David and Solomon lay, and two of his guards died there, struck down, it was said, by a burst of flame as they went in. Herod himself came out terrified, and as an offering to appease his fear, he had a monument of white stone built at the entrance, at great expense. Nicolaus, the historian of his time, mentions this construction, though not that Herod actually went down into the tomb, since he knew the deed was not a creditable one. Indeed, this is the manner in which Nicolaus treats the rest of his history, as well. Since he lived in the kingdom and was on close terms with Herod and served him, he wrote as an aide, touching only on what brought Herod glory, and working hard to justify or else conceal entirely many things that were plainly unjust, he who even falsified the truth about Mariam's death and that of her sons, so brutally carried out by the king, wanting to give it a respectable appearance, slandering her as licentious and the young men as conspirators. Throughout his history, he consistently praised beyond measure the king's just deeds, while zealously defending his lawless ones. One might well forgive him for this, as I have said, for he was composing not a history for others, but a service for his king. We, however, being of a family closely related to the Hasmonean kings, and for that reason holding the priesthood with honor, consider it unseemly to lie about them. And so we set forth these matters purely and justly, even though we hold many of that family's descendants, some of them still reigning in respect, yet we have honored the truth above them. A truth which, whenever it was justly told, has brought upon its tellers the anger of those very people. As for Herod, because of the undertaking he carried out at the tomb, his fortunes seemed to grow worse within his household, whether the divine anger, provoked by what he had already done wrong before, now grew to bring about irreparable disasters, or whether fortune simply chose that moment to strike, so that the timing lent no small credibility to the belief that his calamities came upon him because of his impiety. For there was, in effect, civil strife within the palace, and mutual hatred surpassing one another in slander. Antipater was always maneuvering against his brothers, skilled at surrounding them with accusations from outside, while he himself often took the place of the one defending them, so that whatever appeared to be his goodwill toward them would seem trustworthy for the schemes he had in mind. In this fashion, by various means, he had thoroughly circumvented his father, persuading him that he alone did everything for his safety. He had also won over Ptolemy, who managed the kingdom's affairs, to Antipater's side, and took counsel with Antipater's mother about urgent matters. In short, these two controlled everything, free to do whatever they wished, and to turn the king against those outside the family, whenever it seemed to their advantage. The sons of Mariam, meanwhile, were always more resentful, unable to bear, given their noble birth, being pushed aside and made to hold a lesser rank. As for the women, Glaphyra, daughter of Archelaus and wife of Alexander, hated Salome both because of her disposition toward her husband, and because she seemed to look down on Salome's daughter, for she was married to Aristobulus, and Glaphyra resented her equal standing. Once this second quarrel had broken out, not even Pheroras, the king's brother, was free of turmoil, for he had his own private grounds for suspicion and hatred. He had fallen in love with a slave woman of his, and was so utterly overcome and possessed by his passion for her that he scorned even the king's own daughter, to whom he was betrothed, keeping his mind fixed on the slave instead. Herod was angered at this slight, both because of the many benefits he had conferred on his brother, and because he had made him a partner in the kingdom's power, seeing no comparable return, he felt himself disgraced even in the eyes of the world. So, when Pheroras was refused the girl in due course, Herod gave her to the son of Phasael instead. After some time had passed, thinking that his brother's passion had by now surely subsided, Herod reproached him over the earlier match and asked him to take his second daughter, Cypros, in marriage. Ptolemy advised Pheroras, who had by now stopped feeling shame before his brother, to abandon his passion, saying it was disgraceful for a man overcome by a slave woman to deprive himself of the king's goodwill, and on top of that, to become for Herod a source of turmoil and hatred. Seeing that this advice would serve him well, since he had already once been under suspicion and had been forgiven, Pheroras sent the woman away, though he had a child by her already, and promised the king he would take his second daughter, setting the wedding for the 30th day, and swearing along with this that he would have nothing more to do with the woman he had dismissed. But when the 30 days had passed, he was so much the slave of his passion that he did none of what he had promised, and returned again to his first attachment. This now openly grieved Herod and roused him to anger. Certain remarks kept slipping out from him, and many made use of the king's anger as an occasion to slander Pheroras further. There was scarcely a day or an hour in which Herod could remain at peace. Something new was constantly arising out of the rivalries his kinsmen and closest relations kept stirring up against one another. Salome, harsh and ill-disposed toward Mariam's sons, would not even allow her own daughter, married to Aristobulus, one of the young men, to show him the affection due a husband. She persuaded her to report whatever he said in private, and to inform her even of their disagreements, of which there were many, thereby feeding a great many suspicions. Through this, she learned everything about them, while at the same time making her daughter ill-disposed toward the young man. To please her mother, the daughter often reported that the brothers, in private, kept the memory of Mariam alive, hated their father, and constantly threatened that, should they ever come to power, they would appoint the sons Herod had by his other wives as village clerks, since their current studious devotion to learning suited them for nothing better. And as for the wives, if they ever saw them wearing their mother's ornaments, they would strip them of their present finery and confine them dressed in rags, not even allowed to see the sun. All this was at once reported to the king through Salome, and he listened to it with pain. He tried to set matters right, but he was worn down by the suspicions, and, growing ever worse, came to believe everyone against everyone. Even so, on that occasion, after rebuking the young men, once they had defended themselves, he was somewhat relieved for the time being. But far worse news fell upon him not long after. For Pheroras went to Alexander, who, as we have said, was married to Glaphyra, daughter of Archelaus, and told him that he had heard from Salome that Herod was overcome with passion for Glaphyra, and that his desire for her was beyond consolation. On hearing this, Alexander, being young and prone to jealousy, blazed up and took unable to bear it. He was thrown into confusion by the falsehood of the slander. Often he lamented the wickedness of his own household, seeing what he had been to them and what he was getting in return from them. He sent for Pheroras, and after reproaching him, he said, "Vilest of all men, have you come to such unmeasured and excessive ingratitude that you could think such things about me, let alone say them? Don't I see your purpose in bringing such talk to my son, making it into a plot, and a poison meant to destroy me? For who, unless he had enjoyed the favor of some good spirit, as this boy has, would have refrained from punishing his father over such a suspicion? Do you think you were casting a word into his soul, or a sword into the hand raised against the man who begot him? And what do you mean by hating him and his brother, yet feigning goodwill toward them only so as to speak this slander against me, and to say things that it took your own impiety both to conceive and to spread? Go to ruin, you who have proved yourself so vile toward a benefactor and a brother. May this be the conscience you live with for the rest of your life, while I go on winning out over my own kin, neither taking the revenge they deserve nor doing them more good than they are entitled to receive." Such were the king's words. Pheroras, caught in the act of his own villainy, said that Salome had persuaded him to say these things and that the words were hers. She, as soon as she heard this, for she happened to be present, cried out convincingly that nothing of the sort had come from her, and that everyone was eager to bring her into the king's hatred, and to hold it against her in every way, because of the goodwill she bore Herod, always foreseeing dangers on his behalf ahead of everyone else, and that, at this very moment, she was being plotted against all the more. For it was she alone who had persuaded her brother to cast out the wife he had and marry the king's daughter, and it was only natural that he should hate her for it. As she said this, over and over again clutching at her hair and beating her breast, her outward appearance carried some plausibility toward her denial, but the malice of her character betrayed the pretense running through it all. Pheroras was caught in the middle with nothing decent to say in his own defense. He had admitted to speaking the words, but was not believed when he claimed only to have heard them from another. The confusion and the exchange of accusations back and forth grew still greater. In the end, the king, now hating both his brother and his sister, sent them away, praised his son for his self-restraint and for bringing the matter to him, and since it was now late in the day, turned to the care of his body. Once this quarrel had broken out, Salome came off badly from it, since it seemed that the slander had originated with her. And the king's wives were displeased with her, knowing her nature to be most difficult, and how she became by turns an enemy and a friend, as the moment suited her. So they were always saying something to Herod against her, and one incident that occurred gave them still greater license to speak freely on the subject. The king of Arabia, Abodas, was an unambitious man, sluggish by nature, and it was Silius who managed most of his affairs for him, a clever man, still young in years and handsome. Coming to Herod on some business, he saw Salome at dinner and set his mind on her, and knowing that she happened to be a widow, he spoke with her. Salome, who was faring worse than before at her brother's hands and did not look on the young man without feeling, was eager for the marriage. And at the successive dinners they attended there appeared between them rather more warmth and less restraint than was proper given how matters stood between the two of them. The women reported this to the king, mocking the impropriety of it, and Herod made inquiries of Pheroras as well, and asked him to watch, during dinner, how the two of them behaved toward each other. Ferraris reported back that by nods and glances, both of them made their inclination unmistakable. After this, the Arab, growing suspicious, went away. But after an interval of 2 or 3 months, he came again for this very purpose and put a proposal to Herod, asking that Salome be given him in marriage. For the alliance, he said, would not be without advantage, joined as it would be to the rule of the Arabs, which even now was in fact largely in his hands and would belong to him still more fully in time. When Herod put the proposal to his sister and asked whether she was ready for the marriage, she accepted at once. But when they required Silius to be circumcised according to Jewish custom before the marriage could take place, since otherwise it was impossible, he would not submit to it, and saying that he would even be stoned by the Arabs if he did such a thing, he departed. So Pharaoh's, and still more the king's wives, now accused Salome of licentiousness, saying that she had had relations with the Arab.